in full assembly. The Father of Gods and Men began first to speak. Zeus was sorely vexed at the mean way men perpetually acted toward the gods, blaming the divine powers for what their own wickedness brought about, and that too even when the Olympians had tried to hold them back. "You all know about Aegisthus, whom Agamemnon's son Orestes has slain," Zeus said. "How he loved the wife of Agamemnon and killed him on his return from Troy. Certainly no blame attaches to us from that. We warned him by the mouth of Hermes. The death of the son of Atreus will be avenged by Orestes." Those were Hermes' very words, but not even such friendly advice could restrain Aegisthus, who now pays the final penalty. This passage in the Iliad is the first mention of the house of Atreus. In the Odyssey, when Odysseus reached the land of the Phaeacians and was telling them about his descent to Hades and the ghosts he encountered, he said that of them all, the spirit of Agamemnon had most moved him to pity. He had begged him to say how he died, and the chief told him that he was killed ingloriously as he sat at table, struck down as one butchers an ox. "It was Aegisthus," he said, "with the aid of my accursed wife. He invited me to his house, and as I feasted, he killed me. My men, too. You have seen many die in single combat or in battle, but never one who died as we did, by the wine bowl and the loaded tables in a hall where the floor flowed with blood." Cassandra's death shriek rang in my ears as she fell. "Clytemnestra slew her, over my body. I tried to lift up my hands for her, but they fell back. I was dying then." That was the way the story was first told. Agamemnon had been killed by his wife's lover. It was a sordid tale. How long it held the stage, we do not know. But the next account we have, centuries later, written by Aeschylus about 450 BC, is very different. It is a great story now, of implacable vengeance and tragic passions and inevitable doom. The motive for Agamemnon's death is no longer the guilty love of a man and a woman, but a mother's love for a daughter killed by her own father, and a wife's determination to avenge that death by killing her husband. Aegisthus fades. He is hardly in the picture. The wife of Agamemnon, Clytemnestra, has all the foreground to herself. The two sons of Atreus, Agamemnon, the commander of the Greek forces at Troy, and Menelaus, the husband of Helen, ended their lives very differently. Menelaus, at first the less successful, was notably prosperous in his later years. He lost his wife for a time, but after the fall of Troy, he got her back. His ship was driven all the way to Egypt by the storm Athena sent to the Greek fleet. But finally, he reached home safely and lived happily with Helen ever after. It was far otherwise with his brother. When Troy fell, Agamemnon was the most fortunate of the victorious chieftains. His ship came safely through the storm, which wrecked or drove to distant countries so many others. He entered his city not only safe after peril by land and sea, but triumphant, the proud conqueror of Troy. His home was expecting him. Word had been sent that he had landed, and the townspeople joined in a great welcome to him. It seemed that he was, of all men, the most gloriously successful. After a brilliant victory, back with his own again, peace and prosperity before him. But in the crowd that greeted him with thanksgiving for his return, there were anxious faces, and words of dark foreboding passed from one man to another. "He will find evil happenings," they muttered. "Things once were right there in the palace, but no more. That house could tell a tale if it could speak." Before the palace, the elders of the city were gathered to do their king honor. But they, too, were in distress, with a still heavier anxiety, a darker foreboding than that which weighed upon the doubtful crowd. As they waited, they talked in low tones of the past. They were old, and it was almost more real to them than the present. They recalled the sacrifice of Iphigenia, lovely, innocent young thing, trusting her father utterly, and then confronted with the altar, the cruel knives, and only pitiless faces around her. As the old men spoke, it was like a vivid memory to them, as if they themselves had been there, as if they had heard, with her, the father she loved, telling men to lift her and hold her over the altar to slay her. He had killed her, not willingly, but driven by the army impatient for good winds to sail to Troy. And yet, the matter was not as simple as that. He yielded to the army because the old wickedness in generation after generation of his race was bound to work out in evil for him, too. The elders knew the curse that hung over the house. The thirst for blood, it is in their flesh. Before the old wound can be healed, there is fresh blood flowing. 10 years had passed since Iphigenia died, but the results of her death reached through to the present. The elders were wise. They had learned that every sin causes fresh sin. Every wrong brings another in its train. A menace from the dead girl hung over her father in this hour of triumph. And yet, perhaps, they said to each other, perhaps it would not take actual shape for a time. So they tried to find some bit of hope, but at the bottom of their hearts they knew and dared not say aloud that vengeance was already there in the palace, waiting for Agamemnon. It had waited ever since the queen, Clytemnestra, had come back from Aulis, where she had seen her daughter die. She did not keep faith with her husband who had killed her child and his. She took a lover, and all the people knew it. They knew, too, that she had not sent him away when the news of Agamemnon's return reached her. He was still there with her. What was being planned behind the palace doors? As they wondered and feared, a tumult of noise reached them. Chariots rolling, voices shouting. Into the courtyard swept the royal car with the king, and beside him, a girl, very beautiful, but very strange-looking. Attendants and townspeople were following them, and as they came to a halt, the doors of the great house swung open, and the queen appeared. The king dismounted, praying aloud, "O victory, now mine, be mine forever!" His wife advanced to meet him. Her face was radiant, her head high. She knew that every man there except Agamemnon was aware of her infidelity, but she faced them all and told them, with smiling lips, that even in their presence she must at such a moment speak out the great love she bore her husband and the agonizing grief she had suffered in his absence. Then, in words of exultant joy, she bade him welcome. "You are our safety," she told him, "our sure defense. The sight of you is dear as land after storm to the sailor, as a gushing stream to a thirsty wayfarer." He answered her, but with reserve, and he turned to go into the palace. First, he pointed to the girl in the chariot. She was Cassandra, Priam's daughter, he told his wife, the army's gift to him, the flower of all the captive women. Let Clytemnestra see to her and treat her well. With that, he entered the house, and the doors closed behind the husband and the wife. They would never open again for both of them. The crowd had gone. Only the old men still waited uneasily before the silent building and the blank doors. The captive princess caught their attention, and they looked curiously at her. They had heard of her strange fame as a prophetess whom no one ever believed and yet whose prophecies were always proved true by the event. She turned a terrified face to them. Where had she been brought? She asked them wildly. What house was this? They answered soothingly that it was where the son of Atreus lived. She cried out, No, it is a house God hates, where men are killed and the floor is red with blood. The old men stole frightened glances at each other. Blood, men killed. That was what they too were thinking of, the dark past with its promise of more darkness. How could she, a stranger and a foreigner, know that past? I hear children crying, she wailed. Crying for wounds that bleed, a father feasted, and the flesh, his children. Thyestes and his sons. Where had she heard of that? More wild words poured from her lips. It seemed as if she had seen what had happened in that house through the years, as if she had stood by while death followed death, each a crime and all working together to produce more crime. Then, from the past, she turned to the future. She cried out that on that very day, two more deaths would be added to the list. One, her own. I will endure to die, she said, as she turned away and moved toward the palace. They tried to hold her back from that ominous house, but she would not have it. She entered, and the doors closed forever on her, too. The silence that followed when she had gone was suddenly and terribly broken. A cry rang out, the voice of a man in agony. God, I am struck, my death blow. And silence again. The old men, terrified, bewildered, huddled together. That was the king's voice. What should they do? Break into the palace? Quick, be quick, they urged each other. We must know. But there was no need now of any violence. The doors opened, and on the threshold stood the queen. Dark red stains were on her dress, her hands, her face. Yet she herself looked unshaken, strongly sure of herself. She proclaimed for all to hear what had been done. Here lies my husband dead, struck down justly by my hand, she said. It was his blood that stained her dress and face, and she was glad. He fell, and as he gasped, his blood spouted and splashed me with a dark spray, a dew of death, sweet to me as heaven's sweet raindrops when the cornland buds. She saw no reason to explain her act or excuse it. She was not a murderer in her own eyes. She was an executioner. She had punished a murderer. The murderer of his own child. Who cared no more than if a beast should die when flocks are plenty in the fleecy fold, but slew his daughter, slew her for a charm against the Thracian winds. Her lover followed her and stood beside her. Aegisthus, the youngest child of Thyestes, born after that horrible feast. He had no quarrel with Agamemnon himself, but Atreus, who had had the children slaughtered and placed on the banquet table for their father, was dead, and vengeance could not reach him. Therefore his son must pay the penalty. The two, the queen and her lover, had reason to know that wickedness cannot be ended by wickedness. The dead body of the man they had just killed was a proof. But in their triumph, they did not stop to think that this death, too, like all the others, would surely bring evil in its train. No more blood for you and me, Clytemnestra said to Aegisthus. We are lords here now. We too will order all things well. It was a baseless hope. Iphigenia had been one of three children. The other two were a girl and a boy, Electra and Orestes. Aegisthus would certainly have killed the boy if Orestes had been there, but he had been sent away to a trusted friend. The girl, Aegisthus disdained to kill. He only made her utterly wretched in every way possible, until her whole life was concentrated in one hope, that Orestes would come back and avenge their father. That vengeance, what would it be? Over and over she asked herself this. Aegisthus, of course, must die, but to kill him alone would never satisfy justice. His crime was less black than another's. What then? Could it be justice that a son should take a mother's life to avenge a father's death? So she brooded through the bitter days of the long years that followed, while Clytemnestra and Aegisthus ruled the land. As the boy grew to manhood, he saw even more clearly than she the terrible situation. It was a son's duty to kill his father's murderers, a duty that came before all others. But a son who killed his mother was abhorrent to gods and to men. A most sacred obligation was bound up with a most atrocious crime. He who wanted only to do right was so placed that he must choose between two hideous wrongs. He must be a traitor to his father, or he must be the murderer of his mother. In his agony of doubt, he journeyed to Delphi to ask the oracle to help him, and Apollo spoke to him in clear words, bidding him, "Slay the two who slew. Atone for death by death. Shed blood for old blood shed." And Orestes knew that he must work out the curse of his house, exact vengeance, and pay with his own ruin. He went to the home he had not seen since he was a little boy, and with him went his cousin and friend, Pylades. The two had grown up together and were devoted in a way far beyond usual friendship. Electra, with no idea that they were actually arriving, was yet on the watch. Her life was spent in watching for the brother who would bring her the only thing life held for her. One day at her father's tomb, she made an offering to the dead and prayed, "O Father, guide Orestes to his home." Suddenly, he was beside her, claiming her as his sister, showing her as proof the cloak he wore, the work of her hands, which she had wrapped him in when he went away. But she did not need a proof. She cried, "Your face is my father's face," and she poured out to him all the love no one had wanted from her through the wretched years. All is yours, the love I owed my father, who is dead, the love I might have given to my mother, and my poor sister, cruelly doomed to die. All yours now, only yours." He was too sunk in his own thought, too intent upon the thing he faced, to answer her, or even to listen. He broke in upon her words to tell her what filled his mind so that nothing else could reach it, the terrible words of the oracle of Apollo. Orestes spoke with horror. "He told me to appease the angry dead, that who hears not when his dead cry to him, for such there is no home, no refuge anywhere. No altar fire burns for him, no friend greets him. He dies alone and vile. O God, shall I believe such oracles? But yet, the deed is to be done, and I must do it." The three made their plans. Orestes and Pylades were to go to the palace, claiming to be the bearers of a message that Orestes had died. It would be joyful news to Clytemnestra and Aegisthus, who had always feared what he might do, and they would certainly want to see the messengers. Once in the palace, the brother and his friend could trust to their own swords and the complete surprise of their attack. They were admitted, and Electra waited. That had been her bitter part all through her life. Then the doors opened slowly, and a woman came out and stood tranquilly on the steps. It was Clytemnestra. She had been there only a moment or so when a slave rushed out, screaming, "Treason! Our master! Treason!" He saw Clytemnestra and gasped, "Orestes! Alive! Here!" She knew then. Everything was clear to her, what had happened, and what was still to come. Sternly she bade the slave bring her a battle axe. She was resolved to fight for her life, but the weapon was no sooner in her hand than she changed her mind. A man came through the doors, his sword red with blood, whose blood she knew. And she knew, too, who held the sword. Instantly she saw a surer way to defend herself than with an axe. She was the mother of the man before her. "Stop, my son," she said. "Look, my breast, your heavy head dropped on it, and you slept, oh, many a time. Your baby mouth, where never a tooth was, sucked the milk, and so you grew." Orestes cried, "Oh, Pylades, she is my mother. May I spare—" His friend told him solemnly, "No. Apollo had commanded. The god must be obeyed." "I will obey," Orestes said. "You, follow me." Clytemnestra knew that she had lost. She said calmly, "It seems, my son, that you will kill your mother." He motioned her into the house. She went, and he followed her. When he came out again, those waiting in the courtyard did not need to be told what he had done. Asking no questions, they watched him, their master now, with compassion. He seemed not to see them. He was looking at a horror beyond them. Stammering words came from his lips. "The man is dead. I am not guilty there. An adulterer, he had to die. But she, did she do it, or did she not? Oh, you, my friends, I say I killed my mother. Yet not without reason. She was vile, and she killed my father, and God hated her." His eyes were fixed always on that unseen horror. He screamed, "Look, look! Women there, black, all black, and long hair like snakes." They told him eagerly there were no women. "It is only your fancy. Oh, do not fear." "You do not see them," he cried. "No fancy. I see them. My mother has sent them. They crowd around me and their eyes drip blood. Oh, let me go." He rushed away, alone, except for those invisible companions. When next he came to his country, years had passed. He had been a wanderer in many lands, always pursued by the same terrible shapes. He was worn with suffering, but in his loss of everything men prize, there was a gain, too. "I have been taught by misery," he said. He had learned that no crime was beyond atonement, that even he, defiled by a mother's murder, could be made clean again. He traveled to Athens, sent there by Apollo to plead his case before Athena. He had come to beg for help. Nevertheless, in his heart there was confidence. Those who desire to be purified cannot be refused, and the black stain of his guilt had grown fainter and fainter through his years of lonely wandering and pain. He believed that by now it had faded away. "I can speak to Athena with pure lips," he said. The goddess listened to his plea. Apollo was beside him. "It is I who am answerable for what he did," he said. "He killed at my command." The dread forms of his pursuers, the Erinyes, the Furies, were arrayed against him, but Orestes listened calmly to their demand for vengeance. "I, not Apollo, was guilty of my mother's murder," he said, but I have been cleansed of my guilt. These were words never spoken before by any of the house of Atreus. The killers of that race had never suffered from their guilt and sought to be made clean. Athena accepted the plea. She persuaded the avenging goddesses also to accept it. And, with this new law of mercy established, they themselves were changed. From the Furies of frightful aspect, they became the Benignant Ones, the Eumenides, protectors of the suppliant. They acquitted Orestes, and with the words of acquittal, the spirit of evil which had haunted his house for so long was banished. Orestes went forth from Athena's tribunal a free man. Neither he nor any descendant of his would ever again be driven into evil by the irresistible power of the past. The curse of the house of Atreus was ended. Iphigenia among the Taurians. I have taken this story entirely from two plays of Euripides, the 5th-century tragic poet. No other writer tells the story in full. The happy end brought about by a divinity, the Deus ex machina, is a common device with Euripides alone of the 3 tragic poets. According to our ideas, it is a weakness, and certainly it is unnecessary in this case, where the same end could have been secured by merely omitting the headwind. Athena's appearance, in point of fact, harms a good plot. A possible reason for this lapse on the part of one of the greatest poets the world has known is that the Athenians, who were suffering greatly at the time from the war with Sparta, were eager for miracles, and that Euripides chose to humor them. The Greeks, as has been said, did not like stories in which human beings were offered up, whether to appease angry gods, or to make Mother Earth bear a good harvest, or to bring about anything whatsoever. They thought about such sacrifices as we do. They were abominable. Any deity who demanded them was thereby proved to be evil. And, as the poet Euripides said, if gods do evil, then they are not gods. It was inevitable, therefore, that another story should grow up about the sacrifice of Iphigenia at Aulis. According to the old account, she was killed because one of the wild animals Artemis loved had been slain by the Greeks, and the guilty hunters could win back the goddess's favor only by the death of a young girl. But to the later Greeks, this was to slander Artemis. Never would such a demand have been made by the lovely lady of the woodland and the forest, who was especially the protector of little helpless creatures. So gentle is she, Artemis the holy, to dewy youth, to tender nurslings, the young of all that roam the meadow, of all who live within the forest. So another ending was given to the story. When the Greek soldiers at Aulis came to get Iphigenia, where she was waiting for the summons to death, her mother beside her, she forbade Clytemnestra to go with her to the altar. "It is better so for me as well as for you," she said. The mother was left alone. At last she saw a man approaching. He was running, and she wondered why anyone should hasten to bring her the tidings he must bear. But he cried out to her, "Wonderful news!" Her daughter had not been sacrificed, he said. That was certain. But exactly what had happened to her no one knew. As the priest was about to strike her, anguish troubled every man there, and all bowed their heads. But a cry came from the priest, and they looked up to see a marvel hardly to be believed. The girl had vanished, but on the ground beside the altar lay a deer, its throat cut. "This is Artemis's doing," the priest proclaimed. "She will not have her altar stained with human blood. She has herself furnished the victim, and she receives the sacrifice." "I tell you, O queen," the messenger said, "I was there, and the thing happened thus. Clearly, your child has been borne away to the gods." But Iphigenia had not been carried to heaven. Artemis had taken her to the land of the Taurians, today the Crimea, on the shore of the unfriendly sea. A fierce people, whose savage custom it was to sacrifice to the goddess any Greek found in the country. Artemis took care that Iphigenia should be safe. She made her priestess of her temple. But as such, it was her terrible task to conduct the sacrifices, not actually herself kill her countrymen, but consecrate them by long-established rites and deliver them over to those who would kill them. She had been serving the goddess thus for many years when a Greek galley put in at the inhospitable shore, not under stern necessity, storm-driven, but voluntarily. And yet it was known everywhere what the Taurians did to the Greeks they captured. An overwhelmingly strong motive made the ship anchor there. From it, in the early dawn, two young men came and stealthily found their way to the temple. Both were clearly of exalted birth. They looked like the sons of kings, but the face of one was deeply marked with lines of pain. It was he who whispered to his friend, "Don't you think this is the temple, Pylades?" "Yes, Orestes," the other answered. "It must be that blood-stained spot." Orestes here? And his faithful friend? What were they doing in a country so perilous to Greeks? Did this happen before or after Orestes had been absolved of the guilt of his mother's murder? It was some time after. Although Athena had pronounced him clear of guilt, in this story, all the Erinyes had not accepted the verdict. Some of them continued to pursue him, or else Orestes thought that they did. Even the acquittal pronounced by Athena had not restored to him his peace of mind. His pursuers were fewer, but they were still with him. In his despair, he went to Delphi. If he could not find help there, in the holiest place of Greece, he could find it nowhere. Apollo's oracle gave him hope, but only at the risk of his life. He must go to the Taurian country, the Delphic priestess said, and bring away the sacred image of Artemis from her temple. When he had set it up in Athens, he would at last be healed and at peace. He would never again see terrible forms haunting him. It was a most perilous enterprise, but everything for him depended on it. At whatever cost, he was bound to make the attempt, and Pylades would not let him make it alone. When the two reached the temple, they saw at once that they must wait for the night before doing anything. There was no chance by day of getting into the place unseen. They retreated to keep under cover in some dark, lonely spot. Iphigenia, sorrowful as always, was going through her round of duties to the goddess when she was interrupted by a messenger who told her that the two young men, Greeks, had been taken prisoners and were to be sacrificed at once. He had been sent on to bid her make all ready for the sacred rites. The horror which she had felt so often seized her again. She shuddered at the thought, terribly familiar though it was, of the hideous bloodshed, of the agony of the victims. But this time, a new thought came as well. She asked herself, would a goddess command such things? Would she take pleasure in sacrificial murder? I do not believe it, she told herself. It is the men of this land who are bloodthirsty, and they lay their own guilt on the gods. As she stood thus, deep in meditation, the captives were led in. She sent the attendants into the temple to make ready for them, and when the three were alone together, she spoke to the young men. Where was their home? She asked. The home which they would never see again. She could not keep her tears back, and they wondered to see her so compassionate. Orestes told her gently not to grieve for them. When they came to the land, they had faced what might befall them. But she continued questioning. Were they brothers? Yes, in love, Orestes replied, but not by birth. What were their names? Why ask that of a man about to die? Orestes said. Will you not even tell me what your city is? She asked. I come from Mycenae, Orestes answered, that city once so prosperous. The king of it was certainly prosperous, Iphigenia said. His name was Agamemnon. I do not know about him, Orestes said abruptly. Let us end this talk. No, no, tell me of him, she begged. Dead, Orestes said. His own wife killed him. Ask me no more. One thing more, she cried. Is she, the wife, alive? No, Orestes told her. Her son killed her. The three looked at each other in silence. It was just, Iphigenia whispered, shuddering. Just, yet evil, horrible. She tried to collect herself. Then she asked, Do they ever speak of the daughter who was sacrificed? Only as one speaks of the dead, Orestes said. Iphigenia's face changed. She looked eager, alert. I have thought of a plan to help both you and me, she said. Would you be willing to carry a letter to my friends in Mycenae if I can save you? No, not I, Orestes said, but my friend will. He came here only for my sake. Give him your letter and kill me. So be it, Iphigenia answered. Wait while I fetch the letter. She hurried away and Pylades turned to Orestes. I will not leave you here to die alone, he told him. All will call me a coward if I do so. No, I love you, and I fear what men may say. I gave my sister to you to protect, Orestes said. Electra is your wife. You cannot abandon her. As for me, it is no misfortune for me to die. As they spoke to each other in hurried whispers, Iphigenia entered with a letter in her hand. I will persuade the king. He will let my messenger go, I am sure. But first, she turned to Pylades, I will tell you what is in the letter, so that even if through some mischance you lose your belongings, you will carry my message in your memory and bear it to my friends. A good plan, Pylades said. To whom am I to bear it? To Orestes, Iphigenia said. Agamemnon's son. She was looking away. Her thoughts were in Mycenae. She did not see the startled gaze the two men fixed on her. You must say to him, she went on, that she who was sacrificed at Aulis sends this message. She is not dead. Can the dead return to life? Orestes cried. Be still, Iphigenia said with anger. The time is short. Say to him, Brother, bring me back home. Free me from this murderous priesthood, this barbarous land. Mark well, young man, the name is Orestes. Oh, God, God, Orestes groaned. It is not credible. I am speaking to you, not to him, Iphigenia said to Pylades. You will remember the name? Yes, Pylades answered, but it will not take me long to deliver your message. Orestes, here is a letter. I bring it from your sister. And I accept it, Orestes said, with a happiness words cannot utter. The next moment he held Iphigenia in his arms, but she freed herself. I do not know, she cried. How can I know? What proof is there? Do you remember the last bit of embroidery you did before you went to Aulis? Orestes asked. I will describe it to you. Do you remember your chamber in the palace? I will tell you what was there. He convinced her, and she threw herself into his arms. She sobbed out, Dearest, you are my dearest, my darling, my dear one. A baby, a little baby when I left you. More than marvelous is this thing that has come to me. Poor girl, Orestes said, mated to sorrow. as I have been, and you might have killed your own brother.
Oh, horrible, Iphigenia cried, but I have brought myself to do horrible things. These hands might have slain you, and even now, how can I save you? What god, what man will help us?
Pylades had been waiting in silence, sympathetic but impatient. He thought the hour for action had emphatically arrived. We can talk, he reminded the brother and sister, when once we are out of this dreadful place. Suppose we kill the king, Orestes proposed eagerly, but Iphigenia rejected the idea with indignation. King Thoas had been kind to her. She would not harm him. At that moment, a plan flashed into her mind, perfect down to the last detail. Hurriedly she explained it, and the young men agreed at once. All three then entered the temple. After a few moments, Iphigenia came out bearing an image in her arms. A man was just stepping across the threshold of the temple enclosure. Iphigenia cried out, O king, halt! Stay where you are! In astonishment, he asked her what was happening. She told him that the two men he had sent her for the goddess were not pure. They were tainted, vile. They had killed their mother, and Artemis was angry. I am taking the image to the seashore to purify it, she said, and there too I will cleanse the men from their pollution. Only after that can the sacrifice be made. All that I do must be done in solitude. Let the captives be brought forth and proclaim to the city that no one may draw near to me.
Do as you wish, Thoas answered, and take all the time you need.
He watched the procession move off, Iphigenia leading with the image, Orestes and Pylades following, and attendants carrying vessels for the purifying rite. Iphigenia was praying aloud, Maiden and queen, daughter of Zeus and Leto, you shall dwell where purity is, and we shall be happy. They passed out of sight on their way to the inlet where Orestes' ship lay. It seemed as if Iphigenia's plan could not fail. And yet, it did. She was able indeed to make the attendants leave her alone with her brother and Pylades before they reached the sea. They stood in awe of her, and they did just what she bade them. Then the three made all haste and boarded the ship, and the crew pushed it off. But at the mouth of the harbor where it opened out to the sea, a heavy wind, blowing landward, struck them, and they could make no headway against it. They were driven back in spite of all they could do. The vessel seemed rushing on the rocks. The men of the country by now were aroused to what was being done. Some watched to seize the ship when it was stranded. Others ran with the news to King Thoas. Furious with anger, he was hurrying from the temple to capture and put to death the impious strangers and the treacherous priestess, when suddenly, above him, in the air, a radiant form appeared, manifestly a goddess. The king started back, and awe checked his steps.
Stop, O king, the presence said. I am Athena. This is my word to you. Let the ship go. Even now, Poseidon is calming the winds and waves to give it safe passage. Iphigenia and the others are acting under divine guidance. Dismiss your anger.
Thoas answered submissively,
Whatever is your pleasure, goddess, shall be done.
And the watchers on the shore saw the wind shift, the waves subside, and the Greek ship leave the harbor, flying under full sail to the sea beyond.
Chapter 18. The Royal House of Thebes.
The story of the Theban family rivals that of the House of Atreus in fame, and for the same reason. Just as the greatest plays of Aeschylus in the 5th century are about Atreus's descendants, so the greatest plays of his contemporary Sophocles
are about Oedipus and his children. Cadmus and his children. The tale of Cadmus and his daughters is only a prologue to the greater story. It was popular in classical days, and several writers told it in whole or part. I have preferred the account of Apollodorus, who wrote in the 1st or 2nd century AD. He tells it simply and clearly. When Europa was carried away by the bull, her father sent her brothers to search for her, bidding them not to return until they had found her. One of them, Cadmus, instead of looking vaguely here and there, went very sensibly to Delphi to ask Apollo where she was. The god told him not to trouble further about her, or his father's determination not to receive him without her, but to found a city of his own. He would come upon a heifer when he left Delphi, Apollo said. He was to follow her and build his city at the spot where she lay down to rest. In this way, Thebes was founded, and the country round about got the name of the heifer's land, Boeotia. First, however, Cadmus had to fight and kill a terrible dragon which guarded a spring nearby and slew all his companions when they went to get water. Alone, he could never have built the city, but when the dragon was dead, Athena appeared to him and told him to sow the earth with the dragon's teeth. He obeyed, with no idea what was to happen, and to his terror saw armed men spring up from the furrows. However, they paid no attention to him, but turned upon each other, until all were killed except 5, whom Cadmus induced to become his helpers. With the aid of the 5, Cadmus made Thebes a glorious city, and ruled over it in great prosperity and with great wisdom. Herodotus says that he introduced the alphabet into Greece. His wife was Harmonia, the daughter of Ares and Aphrodite. The gods graced their marriage with their presence, and Aphrodite gave Harmonia a wondrous necklace, which had been made by Hephaestus, the workman of Olympus, but which, for all its divine origin, was to bring disaster in a later generation. They had 4 daughters and 1 son, and they learned through their children that the wind of the gods' favor never blows steadily for long. All of their daughters were visited by great misfortunes. One of them was Semele, mother of Dionysus, who perished before the unveiled glory of Zeus. Ino was another. She was the wicked stepmother of Phrixus, the boy who was saved from death by the ram of the golden fleece. Her husband was struck with madness and killed their son, Melicertes. With his dead body in her arms, she leaped into the sea. The gods saved them both, however. She became a sea goddess, the one who saved Odysseus from drowning when his raft was shattered, and her son became a sea god. In the Odyssey, she is still called Ino, but later her name was changed to Leucothea, and her son was called Palaemon. Like her sister Semele, she was fortunate in the end. The 2 others were not. Both suffered through their sons. Agave was the most wretched of all mothers, driven mad by Dionysus so that she believed her son Pentheus was a lion and killed him with her own hands. Autonoe's son was Actaeon, a great hunter. Autonoe was less wretched than Agave in that she did not herself kill her son, but she had to endure his dying a terrible death in the strength of his young manhood. A death, too, completely undeserved. He had done no wrong. He was out hunting, and, hot and thirsty, entered a grotto where a little stream widened into a pool. He wanted only to cool himself in the crystal water, but all unknowing, he had chanced upon the favorite bathing place of Artemis. And at the very moment when the goddess had let fall her garments and stood in her naked beauty on the water's edge. The offended divinity gave not a thought to whether the youth had purposely insulted her or had come there in all innocence. She flung into his face drops from her wet hand, and as they fell upon him, he was changed into a stag. Not only outwardly, his heart became a deer's heart, and he who had never known fear before was afraid and fled. His dogs saw him running and chased him. Even his agony of terror could not make him swift enough to outstrip the keen-scented pack. They fell upon him, his own faithful hounds, and killed him. Thus, great sorrows for their children and grandchildren came upon Cadmus and Harmonia in old age, after great prosperity. After Pentheus died, they fled from Thebes as if trying to flee also from misfortune. But misfortune followed them. When they reached far distant Illyria, the gods changed them into serpents, not as a punishment, for they had done no wrong. Their fate, indeed, was a proof that suffering was not a punishment for wrongdoing. The innocent suffered as often as the guilty. Of all that unfortunate race, no one was more innocent of wrongdoing than Oedipus, a great-great-grandson of Cadmus, and no one suffered so greatly. Oedipus. I have taken this story entirely from Sophocles' play of that name, except for the riddle of the Sphinx, which Sophocles merely alludes to. It is given by many writers, always in substantially the same form. King Laius of Thebes was the third in descent from Cadmus. He married a distant cousin, Jocasta. With their reign, Apollo's oracle at Delphi began to play a leading part in the family's fortunes. Apollo was the god of truth. Whatever the priestess at Delphi said would happen, infallibly came to pass. To attempt to act in such a way that the prophecy would be made void was as futile as to set oneself against the decrees of fate. Nevertheless, when the oracle warned Laius that he would die at the hands of his son, he determined that this should not be. When the child was born, he bound its feet together and had it exposed on a lonely mountain where it must soon die. He felt no more fear. He was sure that on this point he could foretell the future better than the god. His folly was not brought home to him. He was killed, indeed, but he thought the man who attacked him was a stranger. He never knew that in his death he had proved Apollo's truth. When he died, he was away from home, and many years had passed since the baby had been left on the mountain. It was reported that a band of robbers had slain him, together with his attendants, all except one, who brought the news home. The matter was not carefully investigated, because Thebes was in sore straits at the time. The country around was beset by a frightful monster, the Sphinx, a creature shaped like a winged lion, but with the breast and face of a woman. She lay in wait for the wayfarers along the roads to the city, and whomever she seized, she put a riddle to, telling him if he could answer it, she would let him go. No one could, and the horrible creature devoured man after man until the city was in a state of siege. The seven great gates, which were the Thebans' pride, remained closed, and famine drew near to the citizens. So matters stood when there came into the stricken country a stranger, a man of great courage and great intelligence, whose name was Oedipus. He had left his home, Corinth, where he was held to be the son of the king, Polybus, and the reason for his self-exile was another Delphic oracle. Apollo had declared that he was fated to kill his father. He too, like Laius, thought to make it impossible for the oracle to come true. He resolved never to see Polybus again. In his lonely wanderings, he came into the country around Thebes, and he heard what was happening there. He was a homeless, friendless man to whom life meant little, and he determined to seek the Sphinx out and try to solve the riddle. "What creature," the Sphinx asked him,
goes on 4 feet in the morning, on 2 at noonday, on 3 in the evening.
Man, answered Oedipus. In childhood, he creeps on hands and feet. In manhood, he walks erect. In old age, he helps himself with a staff.
It was the right answer. The Sphinx, inexplicably but most fortunately, killed herself. The Thebans were saved. Oedipus gained all and more than he had left. The grateful citizens made him their king, and he married the dead king's wife, Jocasta. For many years they lived happily. It seemed that in this case Apollo's words had been proved to be false. But when their two sons had grown to manhood, Thebes was visited by a terrible plague. A blight fell upon everything. Not only were men dying throughout the country, the flocks and herds and the fruits of the field were blasted as well. Those who were spared death by disease faced death by famine. No one suffered more than Oedipus. He regarded himself as the father of the whole state. The people in it were his children. The misery of each one was his, too. He dispatched Jocasta's brother Creon to Delphi to implore the gods' help. Creon returned with good news. Apollo had declared that the plague would be stayed upon one condition. Whoever had murdered King Laius must be punished. Oedipus was enormously relieved. Surely the men or the man could be found, even after all these years, and they would know well how to punish him. He proclaimed to the people gathered to hear the message Creon brought back, "Let no one of this land give shelter to him. Bar him from your homes as one defiled, companioned by pollution. And solemnly I pray, may he who killed wear out his life in evil, being evil." Oedipus took the matter in hand with energy. He sent for Tiresias, the old blind prophet, the most revered of Thebans. Had he any means of finding out, he asked him, who the guilty were? To his amazement and indignation, the seer at first refused to answer. "For the love of God," Oedipus implored him, "if you have knowledge—"
"Fools," Tiresias said, "fools, all of you. I will not answer."
But when Oedipus went so far as to accuse him of keeping silence because he had himself taken part in the murder, the prophet, in his turn, was angered, and words he had meant never to speak fell heavily from his lips.
"You are yourself the murderer you seek."
To Oedipus, the old man's mind was wandering. What he said was sheer madness. He ordered him out of his sight and never again to appear before him. Jocasta, too, treated the assertion with scorn. "Neither prophets nor oracles have any knowledge," she said. She told her husband how the priestess at Delphi had prophesied that Laius should die at the hand of his son, and how he and she together had seen to it that this should not happen by having the child killed. "And Laius was murdered by robbers, where three roads meet on the way to Delphi," she concluded triumphantly. Oedipus gave her a strange look. "When did this happen?" he asked slowly. "Just before you came to Thebes," she said. "How many were with him?" Oedipus asked. "They were 5 in all," Jocasta spoke quickly. "All killed but one."
"I must see that man," he told her. "Send for him."
"I will," she said, "at once, but I have a right to know what is in your mind."
"You shall know all that I know," he answered. "I went to Delphi just before I came here, because a man had flung it in my face that I was not the son of Polybus. I went to ask the god. He did not answer me, but he told me horrible things, that I should kill my father, marry my mother, and have children men would shudder to look upon. I never went back to Corinth. On my way from Delphi, at a place where three roads